Hello, fellow humans. This is Christine. Just wanted to let you know that this episode contains discussions of a highly sensitive nature that may be emotionally challenging, including sexual violence, self-harm, addiction, and eating disorders. While we believe this is one of our most important episodes yet, please take good care of yourself and feel free to join us for next week's episode if this week's topic is triggering.
Welcome to Uncharted Living. We're your hosts, Christine, Rebecca, and Ty. We are life coaches who are committed to the road less traveled. Join us each week for thought-provoking and entertaining conversations, all designed to help you create your own map. Uncharted Living. It's just the beginning. Don't be afraid to get life started. Welcome, listeners, to the podcast. Today, we are joined by Jasmine Grace Marino. A survivor of sex trafficking and drug addiction, Jasmine is the founder and director of Jasmine Grace Outreach, which empowers women as they exit and recover from the commercial sex trade and addiction. She is the author of The Diary of Jasmine Grace, Trafficked, Recovered, Redeemed. Jasmine has spoken on panels at the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights in New Hampshire and at two side panels for members of the United Nations in New York. She consults with healthcare professionals, law enforcement personnel, educators, and nonprofit organizations, and advises on issues such as safe homes, program growth, curriculum development, survivor support, and peer mentorship. People who were previously uneducated about human trafficking have chosen to support her efforts as a modern-day abolitionist because sex should never be called work. Thank you so much for being here with me, Jasmine.
Yes, thanks for having me. I'm excited.
Well, welcome. This is a heavy topic, but I think a topic in which people could afford to be a lot more educated than they currently are. And so, can you just tell our listeners and me, what is the difference between human trafficking and sex trafficking?
Right. Well, to have sex trafficking, it kind of comes under the umbrella of human trafficking. So you have human trafficking as kind of the overarching umbrella. And then under that, you have labor trafficking, sex trafficking, and domestic servitude, essentially. So sex trafficking in particular, to prove you've been a victim of sex trafficking, when you're an adult victim, you need to prove one of the three elements, which is force, fraud, or coercion. Mm. Now, if you're under 18 and you're a child, obviously you don't have to prove any of those elements because you're a minor and it's illegal to have sex or traffic children.
Right.
By the way, no little girl dreams of becoming a prostitute, right? Little, right. You know, little girls, 12, 13 year olds, we don't call those child prostitutes. We call them victims because they are minors. Mm-hmm. And so under that federal law, that's how you would describe sex trafficking.
Okay. So fraud, force, or coercion for 18,
yes,
for people 18 and older. Okay. So if you could tell us a little bit about your story, and then maybe how those three elements were present in your own story, I think would be really helpful.
But when I think about the elements of force, fraud, or coercion, I did not recognize those. How's that? You know, as a 19-year-old, I met a guy at a local nightclub and he played the boyfriend role. And he got to know me. He bought me a drink, right, at the bar. And then we exchanged phone numbers and we got together a couple days later and he showed up in a champagne colored Mercedes Benz, you know, and there were these elements of, maybe him being a drug dealer, right? Like, you know, he was young, he was probably in his early 20s. I was 19 and having all that money and bling and expensive cars and jewelry is accepted and kind of glamorized, especially when you're a teen. Sure. And I don't mean to sound, you know, like an old lady now, but like the whole rap and hip hop culture, you know, that was something that I was totally into. And that whole life is glamorized and selling drugs is normal and acceptable. Mm-hmm. And so when I was young and naive, unfortunately, I was looking for love in all the wrong places, right? Mm-hmm. And so starting at maybe 12, 13, started struggling in school, hanging out with boys and doing things I shouldn't have been doing, especially older boys. And I was spelling love S-E-X, right? Because I didn't know that's not what you were supposed to do. But if I wasn't giving it away, they were taking it. So I did experience sexual violence as a teen. Wow. And that does create a lot of shame and or trauma. And I didn't have anyone in my life to help me process that. So you just kind of bury it, right? And you move on. And I didn't have a ton of self-worth or identity. And I just wanted to, again, be loved and accepted. Like, what is our number one human need? It's to be loved and accepted. And I was out looking for that, unfortunately, again, in all the wrong places. So when we think of that, why that happens, again, no little girl dreams of becoming a prostitute. You know, even as a kid, I watched the movie Pretty Woman, right? Mm-hmm. So we have to think about how glamorized the commercial sex trade always appears on TV and in the movies and entertainment, again, through music videos, in social media today, right? The commercial sex trade is always sold as women's empowerment. And I'll tell you, my 8 years in the commercial sex trade, Richard Gere never showed up in a Lamborghini and put a string of pearls around my neck, right? And so there's these different streams of influence that put us in these situations on top of our own vulnerabilities and early childhood trauma. That all plays a part as well. And when you think about early childhood trauma, I don't know if you or any of your listeners ever heard of the ACE score, Adverse Childhood Experience. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting and cool to know your own ACE score just because. And so it's 10 questions. And the higher your ACE score, the more at risk you are later in life as an adult for things like substance use, drug addiction, incarceration, domestic violence, trafficking, et cetera. Right. So my ACE score is only a 4. And that's because I didn't have a severely traumatic childhood. The number one thing for most women in the commercial sex trade, statistically, they say between 80 and 90% of women who end up in the commercial sex trade have been sexually abused as children. Wow. So for me, I didn't experience the childhood sexual abuse, but I had dysfunction in my family. My mom suffered severely with mental illness, and my dad wasn't around because he provided for the family. He worked all the time. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of like left on my own from a young age, right? And so I kind of raised myself. And back then, you were on the streets, right? Kids today don't hang out on the streets or the mall as much anymore. They're all online, which is a whole nother conversation about how predators today find their victims. But for me, I was just on the streets and hanging out, doing things I shouldn't have been doing. Again, I'm looking for that connection, that belonging. Yeah. But I went to vocational high school. I wanted to be a hairdresser. So at 18, I graduated with a cosmetology license. I went to community college for journalism. I wanted to be a writer. Wow. So I had goals and dreams and things I wanted to do. But unfortunately, I got sidetracked. And like I said, met a guy at a local nightclub and he bought me a drink. He wasn't a stranger. He knew some of my friends, right? Mm-hmm. When we think of trafficking, sometimes we think of, you know, the guy in the creepy white van that kidnaps and takes people off the streets.
Right.
Or we think of women stuffed in crates or sent to other countries or, you know, coming in from Asia or Thailand or whatever. Like, we have these other thoughts because of, again, the entertainment and the movies and the things we've seen. But really, it looks just like me, right? It looks like your girl next door. Trafficking doesn't discriminate. It happens to every socioeconomic, you know, level, gender, race, doesn't matter. It doesn't discriminate. It can happen to anybody. Again, even with a score of a 4 or a 10, right?
Right.
So it's very coercive and very manipulative. And unfortunately, you don't always see it happening when you're in it because you haven't been educated about it. And so you don't know.
So victims look like, can look like anybody, right? And then traffickers can look like anybody is really what you're saying. And I know that a lot of rape, sexual violence often occurs and sexual abuse occurs with people, you know, at the hands of somebody that is not a stranger. It's someone that the victim knows really quite well. And so I think maybe it, like you said, in our culture and in the movies, there's a big separation and the thought is that it's a stranger and it's somebody much older. But in fact, what you're saying is victims and traffickers actually often know each other.
Yes.
And like you said, doesn't discriminate. So So your quote unquote boyfriend shows up in a champagne Mercedes, and what happens next?
Yeah. So we weren't, you know, necessarily dating at that point. We're just getting to know each other. And we met, I don't know if, so I'm from Massachusetts, obviously you hear the accent, right?
Yes.
So I went to a nightclub called The Palace. It was a really popular nightclub in our area called The Palace. And that's where we were all going. The men were always over 21 and the girls were under. They kind of set it up that way. It was just like a breeding ground for inappropriate things to happen. Yeah. And that's where we met. And as we begin this dating process, you know, maybe 3 to 6 months, he's grooming me. Right. And so I don't realize grooming tactics. He meets my family, comes over for Christmas, Thanksgiving. There's a picture of us in front of my mom's Christmas tree. Wow. And he's taking me out shopping and buying me things and spending money on me, getting my hair and nails done. Mm-hmm. And I had never dated a guy like that. I mean, again, I was just coming out of high school.
Right.
And this guy had loads of money and was just what they would call today, like love bombing, right?
Yeah,
right. Just, you know, but at the same time, planting like seeds of doubt in my mind. Why would you want to go to school for journalism? That's stupid. Why would you want to work at a hair salon? You can own one. I know a way we can make a lot of money, right? And you can have a family and a business and a home and you can have anything that you want. And while he's planting these seeds of doubt in my mind, I'm not thrilled with this idea. Like, you know, and he never like use the word trafficking, pimps, right, prostitutes. Like he didn't use those words. You know, they were all implied, but again, very coercive. And the thing about traffickers is if they can make you believe you chose to become a prostitute, then it's your fault. And you feel like you're the willing participant, so you stay longer. But we don't recognize our own trauma. We don't recognize the coercion. We don't recognize, again, if you've been sexually abused from a young age, and this guy or whoever, a trafficker, comes along and promises you what was so freely taken is now going to get paid for. This seems like an upgrade, right?
Right.
And the commercial sex trade, I don't know if I mentioned this before, but it's always sold as women's empowerment. Like, this is going to liberate you. You can pay for a home and a business and school, and you can do whatever you want because you're going to have all the money.
Right.
And the kicker is you're having sex anyways, you might as well get paid for it. So then you start thinking, you're right. I might as well. I've been giving away for free all this time. And so all these lies, a little bit of truth mixed in with the lies, right? And then it just becomes your identity and you start to believe this. And again, I'm not thrilled. And he's taking time. He's really working on it and planting these seeds. And then I happen to have a best friend who disappears. I don't see her for a few weeks, maybe a month or so, because she gets a new boyfriend. And I, you know, that's normal when you're 19. You know, she is enamored with a new guy. I don't see her. And I get invited to a college party, and it was all these college boys drinking in their dorm. And I preface this by saying, like, I'm not a man hater, right? I'm married. I have sons.
Yes.
We've been all sold a lie. Even the men, right, who consume the porn, who consume, who are the demand, right, who see prostitutes, who consume the commercial sex trade, because we've all been sold a lie that it's women's empowerment, that women like it, and they're on a stage or they're in person or on screen, loving it and smiling and enjoying it. But really, a high percentage of those women are victims of some type of trafficking or sexual abuse, domestic violence, et cetera, or they're addicted, you know, again. So these boys are all drinking and partying, and they tell me that a stripper is coming to be the entertainment. I think nothing of it, right? Totally normal. And as we're there partying, the girl walks in and she goes to take her clothes off, and I realize it's my best friend. Wow. And I didn't know that she was in this life. And so we're shocked and we cry and ruin the party and they kick us out because now we're no fun, right? We're a bunch, we're crying drunk girls. So I go back home to my boyfriend. You know, I say that in quotes, you know, I was in love with this guy. I thought he was my boyfriend. And I go home and I tell him what happened and he knows her trafficker by chance. And a few days later, he takes me to her house. She lives in a really expensive, nice, affluent area of Boston called Chestnut Hill, where no one has any idea that this guy is a trafficker living in this big, beautiful home with a fence around it and a Range Rover and a BMW with all these women. And this is considered his stable because no one's paying attention, right? And no one knows like that this is happening in their own neighborhood. And so I go into the home. It's big. It's beautiful. She has her own room and he has his. And the other women, there were a couple of them. They had to share a room because there was more women than there were bedrooms. And she's calling them her wife-in-laws. and she's calling the guy her man, right? So she's using this language that, like, I didn't even recognize, but yeah. I knew, like, it operated differently than the regular world. And she's has her own bedroom, and she has clothes and shoes and jewelry and Louis Vuitton bags. And she wasn't handcuffed to a radiator. Right. She wasn't drunk or drugged. Mm-hmm. She wasn't beaten. And if anything, she looked good, right? Yeah. So he's like planting those seeds. He's talking me into it. I have my own trauma and stuff that I'm coming from, my own need and desire to be loved and accepted. And then I see her looking like she has it all together, and it kind of seals the deal. Mm. So when he finally asked me again, okay, do you want to go down this massage parlor in Hartford, Connecticut? I say, sure. Right? Because at the other part of it, it wasn't like the hardcore street. Like back in the day in Boston, there was an area called the Combat Zone, and that's where all pimps, traffickers put their victims out on the streets. Mm-hmm. But the streets were getting cleaned up. So really all prostitution was doing was being pushed indoors, right? Trafficking was being pushed indoors. Okay. And there was these infamous massage parlors around New England that had been open for 20, 30 years, you know, all criminally ran, probably mafia connected and all that stuff. I never knew what was going on the higher ups. But today you won't see those American massage parlors, brothels, because they're mostly Asian. And that's a whole other story about the Asian women who do, you know, come from other countries and are trafficked here, and their documents are taken away, and they don't speak the language, and the shame that's connected to that. It's a whole other story. But today everything's online, right? So you're not really going to have American brothels, except for where prostitution is legal, like in Nevada, certain parts of Nevada. The brothels are legal. Women get trafficked through the legal system as well. You know, don't think that that doesn't happen. It most surely does.
So when you were saying pushed indoors, so again, you know, we learn a lot from, or learn incorrectly a lot from TVs and movies. So this isn't the, I mean, going back to Pretty Woman, where someone drives up in this, you know, amazing car, rolls down the window, and there's Julia Roberts in her, you know, her outfit, and, you know, it's this price for this act and this price for this act. And then they get in the car and the end. So like you were saying, to clean up the streets or so, this is still happening. It's just happening in a different forum indoors, which actually seems like even less freedom now for the victims.
And even scarier, because now these girls are, again, I say girls because I'm a female, right? Of course it happens to men, but girls are the majority of the people who get trafficked. And we're indoors, and we're in homes and businesses and hotels, and horrific things happen behind closed doors because no one's out there watching. Absolutely.
Wow. So you were brought to then work at a massage parlor.
Yes.
Which I assume meant what?
Yeah, it was a brothel, right? It posed as a massage parlor. Been in business, again, like 20, 30 years, right in the busy finance district of Hartford. So like people walk by all day or at work. I don't know if they have any idea what's going on behind this big building up on the top floor. And you get in by being buzzed in by the bouncer downstairs, and you're sent with a duffel bag full of condoms, baby wipes, high heel stiletto, skimpy dress. You know, again, think like street kind of wear, you know, Julia Roberts, like that street tight, you know, high heel stiletto kind of thing. And my friend taught me how to hustle, right? How to do the least amount of work to make the most amount of money. And my man was telling me to come out of each session without less than $100. So I had a quota to make. And there were certain rules and things that do's and do not do that you, you know, had to follow.
Wow.
Where a lot of girls without traffickers kind of didn't have that, right? Because they're their own boss, essentially, right? Mm. It's a whole life. It's a whole nother world. And so I'm there, my name gets changed, right? So there goes the identity. Mm. And I have to be this someone else. And I get buzzed in. There's a lounge area that was very dark and musty, no windows. Everything you sat on was kind of sticky and grimy. The little nasty leather couches you sat on. Mm-hmm. All the women were probably 16 to 60, most likely with all what traffic is. That's kind of how they all worked there. Or again, no, I don't call it work. Being exploited there, right?
60
years old. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yep. And it was open from 10 a.m. to 1 a.m. And so you were required to do that whole shift.
Oh my gosh.
Yep. for a few days in a row because we lived far from Connecticut. So probably like 2 hour ride.
Oh my goodness.
And so he sent me there on purpose to break me down mentally, emotionally, physically, spiritually. And if you pass the test, like if you could, you know, stay in Connecticut for however long he told mm-hmm. you to, then you were moved up to another high class, pricier massage parlor in Kittery, Maine. Wow. You know, so they want to break you down as much as they can because they're trying to build you back up into a product. Mm-hmm. So if you pass the test of Connecticut, then you are able to go to this other place. So yeah, so I was sent down there for a few days in a row. And I remember the first time I had to exchange myself, I was completely horrified, disgusted, ashamed. The men come in, they pay a door fee for a half hour or an hour. Then they get to come in the lounge and look around and hand a ticket to whoever they want. Mm. And of course, I was a new girl and he was a regular and he always wanted the newest girl. Wow. And so he hands you the ticket and then you go and you meet in the back where there's a long hallway with 8 or 9 rooms. And in those rooms is a mattress and a nightstand. And I remember what he looks like, his name, his shirt, like all the details, because it's like burned in my brain. Yeah. But in order to cope with this type of trauma, I didn't know this was a thing. I was completely sober at the time. I wasn't on any drugs. I disassociated. Mm-hmm. Out of survival mode, right? Like naturally, like I unplugged and able to cope.
Yeah.
And when it was finally over, like I came back and I remember him handing me a bunch of money. So I look in my hand and I have $80 or $100. And that is what I tried to focus on.
Yeah.
I was like, ooh, look how much money I just made. Like, okay, this isn't so bad. You know, you try to like justify it.
Right.
And I had worked as a hairdresser, maybe making $80 in tips, standing on my feet all day, right? Cutting hair.
Right.
So now I make that quick money. You know, and that creates adrenaline and addiction. And you think about young girls coming out of poverty. That's mm-hmm. another, you know, you think about these push-pull factors and we didn't talk much about the vulnerabilities, you know, for young girls or kids, like domestic violence in the home, drug addiction in the home, poverty, again, mental health issues. Like, again, that whole ACE score thing of, you know, what we experience as a child. Mm-hmm. And when you're coming out of poverty and all of a sudden you got this money running through your hand, the commercial sex trade, whether you have a trafficker or not, always gives you a false sense of power and a false sense of security. Yeah. And you feel like you're the one in control, but ultimately you're not. It's a big lie.
Well, and you mentioned the age and who is actually really vulnerable to be trafficked. And the ACE score is certainly one of it. And for our listeners, we will actually post a link to the ACE score so you can see what we're talking about. But it talks about, you know, different events, traumatic events that have happened and you know, when you're young and how that impacts going forward. It's really, really important. So I'm so glad you brought that up, Jasmine. But even though we know and we have laws that under 18 is, you know, they're automatically victims, they're automatically children. It's not like 18 and one day or eight, you know, a 19-year-old is so much wiser than an 18-year-old or so much wiser than a 17-year-old. So, you know, I think when we say young women, 18 is almost an arbitrary, is almost an arbitrary age, right? It's just, you're still young. And I don't want you to pick an age at which people would be less likely to be so, but it's interesting that at all levels, it seems like there's a lot of vulnerability, even no matter what your ACE score is, just because these are issues that are so, your brain can't even handle it. They're so, I don't want to use this word sophisticated, but so complex and emotionally fraught that
pervasive. Yes.
Yeah. Your brain can't actually understand it at those ages.
Yep.
Now, were you able to keep the money at first? Did you have to, I'm assuming there was a cycle in which you kept less and less of it.
Yeah, I kept none from the jump. Absolutely not. So after those few days in Connecticut, he came and got me. We come home to Boston. It's like daylight, 5, 6 in the morning. Again, this is all on purpose, right? Like break me down, right? So I'm tired. I'm ashamed. It's a few days later. I'm disgusted. We get out of the car and we get to Boston. We get out and I have a pocket full of cash mm-hmm. and we get out to the front of the car and he puts out his hand. And I knew that gesture meant hand it over.
Wow.
But at that moment, I start logically thinking, why would I give you all the money? You mm-hmm. weren't even there. Wait, I thought you're my boyfriend, wait, are you my pimp? If I have a pimp, it's because I need protection on the street. Like, that's logical, right?
Yeah.
I wasn't even on the street. I was in a club. You weren't even there. I just felt so ashamed, so disgusted, so confused. But he made it very obviously known when he put out his hand and looked me dead in the eye and said, is there going to be a problem? Wow. And I was like, no problem. Yeah. And I handed over. And then as I look back, I think, wow, that's the day, you know, I lost my voice, lost my courage. I felt ashamed, was disgusted. I was confused. Mm-hmm. And I went right back home to my parents' house, went back to the hair salon and went back to college. And every few days I disappear and get sent down to Hartford, Connecticut.
Wow.
And I wasn't going to tell my parents, right? Because I didn't have a great relationship with them anyway. No one was really paying attention to me as a 19-year-old.
Yeah.
And you just do your thing. Shame keeps you silent. Like, that's like the number one tool of the enemy, right? Shame keeps you sick, keeps you silent. And maybe after a month or so of this kind of lifestyle, this thing happening to me, I started to speak up and change my mind and say I didn't want to do it anymore. And that's when he started to use violence as a way to keep me under his control. Wow. So we all know what domestic violence is, right? Where power and control is at the center, and they use all the different ways, you know, of abuse to keep you under the thumb. Mm-hmm. And the first time I said something he didn't like, we were driving home from Connecticut. I was driving. He backhands me so hard, this side of my head hits the glass window. Mm. And I had to pull over because my vision became blurry. I didn't know that was a thing, like seeing stars. I was like only on TV. And I pull over and he proceeds to pull me out of the car and beat me on the side of the highway.
Oh my God.
So there was another guy in the back with his girl and they pulled him off of me. They threw me in the back seat and I just cried the whole way home to Boston because that's when I knew, like, oh crap.
Yeah.
Right. What did I get myself into? I mean, I've never been in a domestic violence relationship. My dad never even raised his voice, doesn't even swear. Like, my dad's not that kind of guy. I've never been around that. Like, my extended family was, my mom's side was, you know, really dysfunctional and a lot of addicts and criminal behavior and stuff like that. And I did witness things, but I didn't grow up like heavily in that. Mm-hmm. So I just felt automatically like powerless and like, scared, you know, for lack of better words. And before I know it, I became completely isolated. So now I'm living with him, you know, school's over, the hair salon, all my friends, like nothing's the same. And my life is completely consumed with this life, this way of life. I'm considered his bottom bitch. That's a term they use. I hate that word, but that's a term they use. And that means like you cook, you clean, you do the laundry, you go food shopping, you do everything he tells you to do when he tells you to do it. And all the money that you make goes right to his hand. And to help give an idea, it's almost like being in a cult, right? Because it's mental. It's mental and emotional bondage, right? Yeah. It's on top of the violence and the fear and the shame. And I would stay in this terrible cycle for 5 years. I'd be under him.
Wow.
And it's like there, I haven't done much research or study on it, but like I know deep inside, like it's totally connected to like identity disturbance. Like you literally become someone else and you compartmentalize, like mental, whatever, you know what I mean? Like,
compartmentalize.
Yes. because you also have to be whoever the sex buyer needs you to be each time. And I had tons of different stories. I was, you know, a student at Northeastern. I was a student at BU. My name, my real name, you know, they always want to know your real name, you know, was Maria. It was whatever, you know, you have all these different stories and personalities. And, you know, again, it's a facade, right? You have to act however they want you to make the money because your traffic is expecting, you know, sometimes $1,000 a day.
Well, and that must make the perpetrators or the consumers of this maybe ease their conscience. Oh, well, she's at Northeastern. She's putting herself through school. So this is really for a good cause. I mean, I think, right, that feeds into that false sense of empowerment. Just for our listeners, I mean, I'm stunned. I haven't asked a lot of follow-up questions because I'm sitting here stunned, even though I've known we were going to have this conversation. But it does sound like, I think in our minds or in a lot of people's minds, when we look at TVs and movies, it starts with, we think of coercion first, or we think of force first. Mm. And what you're describing is the fraud that comes first, and then the coercion, and then the force.
I get there.
Yeah.
Because some traffickers, you know, mine was considered a finesse pimp, right? They call the boyfriend Romeo. They have different names. But then you have like gorilla pimps. And these men, you know, already spot the woman's vulnerability. So sometimes traffickers go after girls that already are addicted. And they will use force, and they will use the drugs as a way to keep them, you know, I'm the drug dealer. You're the vulnerable person, the victim. And I'm going to make you do X, Y, and Z before you can even get high, because I'm the one in control. So they use that as a method. I have worked with women who were beat into submission, who were held in cages, storage containers, or sheds in people's backyards. I mean, really brutal things that traffickers do first. You know, it's not all the time coercive like mine. It's probably the most popular method of manipulation, but force definitely does happen first in some people's cases.
Okay.
But I will say, for those 5 years, you know, being under that mental and emotional bondage, I tried to escape many times. And when I say that, like, I saw my primary care physician constantly. I was always at the doctor by myself. He didn't come with me.
Wow.
And I would self-diagnose myself, depression, ADD, ADHD, anxiety, right? Anything I could to try to like med seek, because I was seeking, you know, to try to like numb the pain.
Yeah.
But luckily I didn't get addicted to any prescription meds, because my life would have been way harder to manage. And I probably wouldn't have exited as soon as I did. I would have been, because that's a whole nother layer of bondage, right? When you're addicted.
Yeah, sure.
So I never got addicted to anything in that case. But when we go out and party and go to clubs and stuff, I would drink and be intoxicated. I mean, I couldn't manage any chance I get. And I had other like terrible habits, OCD like habits, where I could control everything I could, because my life was so out of control. So everything was very OCD and obsessive. I washed myself constantly because I felt so disgusting and dirty. I was really thin. I had eating disorders. I worked out like a maniac. Constant lump in my throat, because my body was physically reacting to the stress that I was under. Yeah. But I didn't know. You know, I thought like I had agita, or you call it I'm Italian. You call it heartburn.
Yes.
Right? So like I didn't know what was wrong, because I didn't know your body could like physically do that. And everything was just to the extreme. But I managed to have one good healthy coping skill, and that was to journal. And I'd write down in my notebooks, not like the horrific things I would go through, but more like that mental and emotional stuff. And I would just process by writing, and I would hide all the notebooks so he couldn't find them. Wow. And that was like my one good healthy thing. And because my parents, again, like they had their own issues, but they always lived at the same house. Mm-hmm. And every time I needed help, they always opened the door. And I'm grateful for that, because a lot of women I work with today don't have parents. They have no safe place to go. So they stay in that cycle longer and longer and longer. Yeah. So that was vital for me, to have parents who were, you know, stable in that sense of living somewhere. And so I'd run away there, and I'd stay maybe for a night, two, maybe three, maybe like the most I ever stayed away was like a month from my trafficker. But he would come back, because he knew where I was, and he would badger me, manipulate me, and cry and show up with gifts and diamonds. And I'd go back, because I also believed everything he told me, which was I was a no good, dirty prostitute. No one would ever love me, and I'd never be able to make money like regular again.
Wow.
And I believed all those lies. And so I constantly would just end up going back. And so, yeah. So for 5 years, I'd end up underneath, managed to go through, get an associate's degree from a community college while I was under, you know, him being exploited, because at that massage parlor in Maine that I got, you know, moved to, he was making so much money off of me and many other women. He wanted to open a business as a front. So he actually talked me going to community college, and I got an associate's degree in business, and I made the dean's list. I did really well. I poured everything I could into it, because I figured nothing he tells me is going to come true, but he can't take away the degree.
Yeah.
So I worked hard, and I graduated. I didn't feel accomplished or proud, because I couldn't feel anything. I was completely numb. And it had been just about 5 years at that point. And Maine, the massage parlor, got busted. There was an underage girl working there I didn't recognize at the time. She was your typical story. She was 13. She was a runaway. from the DCF foster care system. And she was picked up by a local trafficker and his bottom girl. And she was up there being exploited. And she had an aunt who was looking for her. Mm. You know, so many kids go missing each year in the U.S., right? And because our system is so big and broken and overloaded, they don't get recovered. And if the average age, they say, is into the commercial sex trade is between 12 and 14. Mm-hmm. And so if these young kids aren't being recovered, and now we see them as adult women still involved in the commercial sex trade, they have drug addictions, they have criminal records, mental health, right? All the things. Because really, they got involved as kids, right?
Yeah.
And so she was recovered, and the club had other money laundering issues and all these other problems. They were so corrupt, obviously. Like the lawyer, they had a lawyer who paid off the local police chief. Like that's how it stayed open. It was just really bad. Wow. And the place got busted, and I had a sense that I was going to get busted. So my trafficker let me leave. Mm-hmm. I had the degree. He let me leave because Craigslist became popular. And so that's when he started posting ads of me all over the internet on Craigslist and other adult sites. And that, again, gave me more freedom in the sense of like I'm going all over New England, sometimes with him or without him. But I was so trained that even when I wasn't with him, I came back home and I put the money exactly where I was supposed to. Mm. And now it had been almost 5 years. Yep.
Wow. So he was the quote finesse boyfriend. I wanted to go back to that really quickly. He called the finesse boyfriend. Yep. Was he still like, did you two, I mean, I've heard the gifts and the, all of that. Were you two still having a physical relationship?
Absolutely.
Okay. So actually a boyfriend or not a real boyfriend, but you know what I mean.
Intimate partner. Yeah.
Yes. Absolutely. Still an intimate partner. And then what was the other kind of quote boyfriend you talked about? Did you say gorilla?
Oh, the trafficker. Yeah. Gorilla pimp, where he just uses violence right off the jump.
Got it. Okay.
He's not interested in manipulating you. He's just gonna beat you right into submission in that sense. Yeah.
Okay. The other thing that I wanted to just, you know, highlight again is that a beautiful thing is that your parents with whatever issues they had always had a door open for their daughter. And I think what I'm hearing is that so many people who run away, I'm guessing a number of kids are actually kicked out of the house for whatever reason and definitely don't have that door open. And so I guess one of the, and we'll talk about this, you know, how can people help and how can we do prevention? I guess for any parents listening, always keeping the door open for your children, no matter what age they are, is important.
Yes. In conversations, hard, difficult, uncomfortable conversations.
Yeah.
Very important.
Yeah. So we're getting to the recovery road kind of part of it. So yeah. So the place in Maine gets busted, severely underage girl. So what happens next?
Yeah. So I'm being trafficked online, and I want to say you don't have to move over state lines too, by the way. You can be trafficked, you know, grow up in Boston and be trafficked in Boston. You don't have to cross state lines. So I don't want to make anyone think that, right. Because he did exploit me in different states and things like that, but that's not a technicality. Right. So yes, he sent me to Nevada, to the legal system. He sent me to Florida to high price escorting. And then in Boston online in fancy hotels and businesses after hours. I can't tell you how many men's homes I went to when the wife and kids weren't there. Oh my you know, God. The demand is huge. If there wasn't such a demand, there wouldn't be such a supply. And, you know, porn is like the gateway drug, kind of like we say marijuana is the gateway drug into hardcore drugs. You know, porn really is that because it just drives this insatiable urge and desire, you know. And obviously men who purchase are coming out of their own sexual brokenness, their own sexual addiction. Mm-hmm. And then you have the trafficker coming out of their own brokenness. They think it's okay to buy and sell humans, right? And then you have the victims. And they're coming in their own vulnerabilities and their own brokenness. So to have this system, you know, you're dealing with these three key people who all have a brokenness that needs healing and redemption. You know, no one's beyond that healing and redemption, even though it can be so evil, you know, for sure. But when you think of it like that, you know, as humanity, it's just so sad. Yeah. But yeah, so I went to many men's homes and businesses, how many men came to Boston, right, on business trips and conferences, et cetera. But there was this one guy who I went to his house. There was a regular call, you know, so I thought, and I got there and nothing happened sexually. And he paid me a lot of money. And week after week, he kept calling me back. And I'd like going there because nothing would happen. And we'd hang out and watch SpongeBob. And we'd laugh and have a good time. Totally random.
Okay.
Right? Yeah, totally random. And this is like a key thing in my story. And I say it because research says that when a woman's ready to leave the commercial sex trade, she needs one safe, supportive person to reach out to.
Just one.
Because she is so isolated, right? Mm-hmm. And so this guy, you know, wouldn't be the most safest guy on the planet, but he never touched me and like never was inappropriate in that sense. And so week after week, I'd go there. My trafficker obviously has no idea that I'm, you know, seeing this other guy on the side here, like that we're friendly. And it's been almost 5 years about this point, maybe about 5 years, and I become pregnant with my trafficker's child.
Oh my goodness.
So a lot of traffickers do impregnate their women on purpose, keeps them under control better. But this was not his deal. And he was forcing me to terminate the pregnancy. And I didn't want to because I thought, wow, look how much money I've made. You know, I used to write down all the time how much I made and take it to him and say, can I retire? Can I, you know, stop working? Again, not shouldn't be called work, but again, can I stop? And to give you an idea, I made $28,000 in 1 month.
Wow.
Yeah. Wow. Right. I barely make that a year doing like my advocacy work that I do now. Right. So in 1 month I made that much money, and think about all the other women he had, you know, at times two, three, four other women, plus the drugs he was selling. He had so much money, and I thought I could for sure stop. Yeah. I can have the baby. I can have the family, the business. Like, look, I have the degree. I got everything, you know, that you needed. Mm-hmm. And he was forcing me. And there was a time in Massachusetts legally where you couldn't have an abortion. I forget what it was, but I know it was like later, you know, in your term. And I was holding on to that time, but he was forcing me. And I knew if I didn't do it, he would just do something horrific to me because he was so violent. You know, he was so violent, and I was just so afraid. And so I did what I had to do, and I went and I had an abortion, and it was so traumatizing and so full of shame. Mm. And it was the second abortion I had. I had one when I was 18. It's a whole nother story how I was like coerced into having an abortion when I was 18 because the guy told me I wasn't ready to be a mother. I was too young. I partied, you know, all the lies, you know, that you believe that motherhood is bad and stuff. And so had the abortion, and I thought, you know what? I got to go. You can use and abuse me all you want, but to make me take a life, like, I'm good. You know, I didn't want to do that. And I know nothing's going to ever come true at this point. So I started saving money without him noticing. And I take a few $100 off the top each time I worked, and I was supposed to put it in a certain place, but I took a few $100 off so he wouldn't notice. I'd put it in Ziploc bags, and I'd tie elastics around it really tight in Ziploc bags and elastics. And I'd put it in the dirt in my potted plants, like those big potted plants on the ground.
Wow.
Because I wanted to save a few $1,000, and I knew he wouldn't look in the dirt for the money because I wanted the plants. And I wanted to get my own place. But how does a woman, you know, walk into a real estate agency? You know, I can't fill out an application. I have no job. I have no reference. I have nothing. I might have, you know, $6,000, but what is that really going to do for me?
Right.
So I reach out to the SpongeBob guy. He happens to own a small business. He owned a corner store, like so random. And I said, hey, my name's not whatever, you know, it's really Jasmine. I'm in a lot of trouble. Can you lie and say that I work for you? Mm. And so he said, sure. And he made me fake pay stubs. And I was able to go into the real estate agency, fill out the application, give my pay stubs and all my cash. And I was able to get the place. But you think about women, like that's a miracle, right? Like everyone exits in their own way.
Yeah.
And I've known women who have like their own safe people, and their stories are all miraculous and amazing. But for me, it really changed the course. But do you think my trafficker is going to let me move with the leather and the granite and all the bling and all this stuff? No, I'm leaving with like trash bags.
Yeah.
You know, I'm leaving with nothing. I call the local police because I knew he wasn't going to let me just move. Mm-hmm. And I was afraid, and the cop came and stood on the porch. I said my boyfriend was going to get mad when I move out. So the cop stood on the porch, and my trafficker stood on the other side, and I left with two trash bags. with nothing. And that's another reason, like, people have to realize why victims stay so long, because you know you've done all that for all those years and you're walking away with zilch. Did you know how hard that is?
Did you end up telling the police, or did the police know what kind of home this was and what was going on the inside? So even then.
Absolutely not. Nope. Absolutely not. Zip, right? You're too loyal. You're too ashamed. Mm. You're trained to not trust law enforcement, right? Mm. Okay. And you're trained to look at the whole world like they're squares or like they're losers and we're above that. And we don't operate like the regular world, you know, et cetera.
Yeah.
And no, the cop didn't come in the house. If he did, he would have noticed like the glaring red flags.
Right.
He didn't follow me to my new apartment, nothing, you know, and I get there and I've got nothing. I'm suicidal. I'm hopeless. I'm scared. I call my mom because again, like I have a mom to call and she doesn't ask questions though, you know, but she shows up and she helps me like put it together. I didn't have, again, the courage to tell her like, mom, I was a prostitute. Like, how do you say that to your mother? You know, when you're in it, when you're currently in it. And she knew he made me do things I didn't want to do. Cause I like alluded to that. And she saw black eyes and bruising and she saw me, you know, again, run away from him and come to her house, things like that. Like she knew it was bad, but she knew how bad.
Yeah.
So she bought me some furniture and I tried to put it together. A couple weeks go by and I panic. I call him back. Trauma bonds or Stockholm syndrome, right?
Yeah.
I have no idea how I'm going to live my life without him. And I know there's rules to this life. If I go out on my own, I'm a renegade. And if he catches me, he'll kill me. Or I choose another pimp or, you know, he purchases me. But how much more violent is he going to be than that guy?
Right.
You know, so I try to stick to what I know and we try to make a deal. I live there. He lives at his house and I give him a cut of the money and it doesn't work. After a few more weeks go by, he comes to the apartment and he breaks in the glass and there's blood and a whole thing. And I just was finished. And I called 911 and he was arrested for domestic violence charges, which was like huge for me. Cause again, I would never tell. And I got a restraining order a couple days later and that kept him away because it was just too much drama, too much heat, you know, I was causing a scene and he didn't want to be around that. So he left me alone and I tried to get a job as a 9-to-5 secretary. And I'm like, a fish out of water. I can't function, right? I can't pay my bills at the end of the month. I can't talk to regular people because I have no idea how to do that. And I'm hanging out with new friends and they're all coming over my big empty apartment with drugs and alcohol and enter in OxyContin. And I was dibbling and dabbling and not realizing I'd become severely addicted. And I did. But really, all I just wanted was for the pain to go away. Right. Can someone just please make the pain go away?
Yeah.
And that was way better and faster than therapy. Right. Sure. Let's face it. Like,
of course,
I was not sitting in front of some trauma therapist telling, I couldn't even articulate, you know, what had happened, but getting high was like a quick, easy fix. And before I know it, I'm pushed back into the life of prostitution, not with a pimp, but with a growing drug habit.
Yeah.
And life would unravel, right? Because you can't do opiates and live a normal, productive life. I'd become a heroin addict, homeless, lost everything, sleeping on park benches, overdosing in Dunkin' Donut bathrooms, living in my car with my dog before it was repossessed. I mean, stealing from my parents, all the things, you know, just became like that typical, you know, junkie, drug addict, homeless, whatever you want to call, prostitute on the street. And time would go on and then I'd finally get clean and sober, but that's like the end. So I don't know if you have any clarifying questions.
I mean, so many, it's just, oh my gosh, I'm sure our listeners are like, oh my gosh, we just want to give you a hug. But you know, we had talked about what victims can look like and what traffickers can look like. And I want to go back to SpongeBob guy because you know, in a way, it sounds like rescuers can look like all different people too. And just, he was a consumer, right? He actually paid for you to, I mean, presumably have sex with him, but he didn't. And he turned out to be, to play a part in the rescue, which I find fascinating. And you mentioned other people's, that you work with, they're quote unquote rescuers or people in the rescue story. Can you tell me a little bit about what other rescuers might look like?
Yeah. So we tend to call them safe people.
safe
people. Instead of rescue is. Because that term, yeah, makes it feel like, I think like every man who listens to this podcast or hears a story like wants to like go on an adult website and rescue women out by like posting fake ads and calling them to their house. And that could be really dangerous and really expensive. but you never know, right? You just never know how you're going to exit. And the safe people, like I have one girl, woman who was being trafficked in New Jersey. And because this was before Uber, she was driving around in taxis all the time. And she'd always get this older Israeli taxi driver. And he could tell she was on drugs and she was skinny and beaten, and he would drive her around. So he knew she was a prostitute. Mm-hmm. And he started building a relationship with her by asking her questions. Mm-hmm. And he'd let her come over his apartment and he'd feed her peanut butter sandwiches and let her feed his cats. You know, he was just appropriate and like interested in building that relationship. And then he reached out to her only family member back in Massachusetts, her aunt, and started sending the money back. She'd give him a little bit each time, and he'd send the money to the aunt. Wow. And when she was finally ready to exit, he was the connector to the aunt, and she was able to get a bus pass and leave.
Wow.
She hadn't spoken to her aunt in a really long time. So like, that's one story. You know, another story, a woman I work with, she came to New Hampshire. She was, you know, flown here by a trafficker from a whole nother state on the West Coast. She was held in this guy's house on a lake, you know, a lake house. He was a doctor. Mm-hmm. And he was trafficking her, keeping her highly medicated and drugged. It's a whole story. But when she got here to the airport, her Uber driver was a woman. And she could sense that something was up with this girl. And she was just, again, listening and building a relationship with her. And then like, gave her phone number and invited her, you know, to the county fair in a couple of weekends, you know, and like built this like relationship with her and kept in contact. And absolutely, when the girl was, you know, recovered and the house actually flooded, it was like a whole big story. She was recovered and actually literally like set freed in a sense. This Uber driver, this woman plays an integral role in her healing and her journey and her recovery.
Amazing.
Because she was just at the right place at the right time and was available and appropriate.
Yeah.
And safe, you know,
safe.
That's all it takes.
Yeah. I love that. So we don't want to use the word rescue, because that actually, you're right. Now that I'm thinking about it and processing it, it imparts, it almost makes the rescuer the hero of the story. And we're not here to be heroes. We're here to be safe people for everyone that we meet. And so one of our questions was, how can the average person, you know, how can the average person help? But it sounds like it starts with just, are you a safe person for people generally?
Generally. And are you having these hard conversations with your family, with the men in your life, with your children? Are you preventing it by, you know, not being a consumer yourself? Reading survivor books, watching real documentaries, following, you know, good, solid ministries and anti-sex trafficking programs on social media, right? Like, are you spreading the truth and not, you know, this fear-based propaganda kind of stuff? Like, you know, have you seen like on social media, like, when women kind of share these posts that like, if you do these certain hand movements, like that means you're being trafficked and like, I need help and I need you to rescue me. Like, that's not even, I don't really think a thing, but like they hype it up and there's so much, I can't think of the word, you know, just hype around it. And like, it's become like the new thing, like the movie, it went from Taken to The Sound of Freedom. Right. And so these extremes, where we're forgetting then what it really looks like here in our own backyard, where it, you know, could be most likely your daughter who's being exploited, or, look how young kids are exposed to porn today, 6, 7, 8 years old.
Yeah.
And predators are, you know, reaching these young kids, and exploiting them so quick and fast. And how about social media that's influencing young girls, thanks to Instagram, right? Like, they all think they need to be filtered and have these provocative photos to have a big following. And we love all the likes and all the attention it gives us. Mm-hmm. And then especially with COVID and everything went online big time, you think of OnlyFans, which is a subscription-based platform where these young girls don't even need a trafficker these days. They get on it, OnlyFans, and they think, hey, I'm already posting half-naked pictures of myself on Instagram. I might as well do it on OnlyFans and now get paid for it. And I have a subscription base and all these people like me and I'm wanted and they're making some money off of it and they end up exploiting themselves. Yeah. Even college girls I talk to who have been approached by older men that call themselves sugar daddies and they're on college campuses posting flyers for young college girls to be their sugar babies. And they think, oh, it's harmless. It's just companionship. And I'm just going out for dinner. But then that door gets opened, and before you know it, it's a slippery slope into prostitution.
So we talked briefly about, you know, when you first tried to leave and you had the trash bags and SpongeBob guy helped you get the apartment. But it sounds like the road to recovery, the road to freedom, is certainly not a straight, easy path. And so, can you tell us a little bit about how many women end up? Almost like just like the addiction, like there'll be a relapse or there'll be a kind of going back to it. And it's not like once I'm free forever. Can you just tell me a little bit about how that looked like for you? And then how did you finally officially kind of get free? And then we'll talk about your organization.
Yeah, sure. Like I said, I got addicted to the OxyContin, which led to, you know, being an IV heroin user. And my brother passed away in 2006, which I didn't share any of his story in the beginning. I had one sibling, and unfortunately, he was sexually abused as a young kid, and he had a lot of trauma, and my family, you know, did nothing about it kind of thing. And he just went on his whole life to struggle and suffer with that. He became a male prostitute himself, contracted HIV, lived that whole, you know, lifestyle of like fast drugs, fast money. And his body was tired. And at 36, he didn't wake up from partying. And when that happened, I had to take another good look at myself and think, wow, if I keep doing this, I'm going to die. My parents are going to have no kids. That's sad. Again, like that was planted inside of me, like as a young kid, like through my grandparents, they were very kind and loving, compassionate. And I knew that this wasn't supposed to be my life. Like I knew I was somebody else. I used to know how to return to who that was. And so finally went into treatment many, many times, but got it in 2007. And I remember being in my last treatment center and a very compassionate counselor there just looked me in the eye with compassion, no judgment. And he said, you never have to sell yourself again. And I thought, wow, I don't? Like, okay, it's not a thing. You know, like I thought that's what was going to be my life forever. And he said that and it changed my thinking and I was able to put down the drugs and I just knew that it went hand in hand. Like I couldn't go out and do that sober. So I put everything down, really was ready to surrender and I was tired and done. And I worked through the 12 steps of AA, NA, found a Christian church, right? So I became a Christian early on in my recovery. And it was really the women in the church who loved me well, took me right under their wing, no judgment. You kind of like Jesus to me, right? Yeah. And the men were appropriate. Imagine, like no one wanted anything. There was no strings attached. Yeah. And I just was really blessed to be in a good place. I had a really good experience in the Christian church in the setting that I was in and it was safe. Yeah. And I recovered, you know, day by day, made plenty of mistakes, still went back to relationships and men looking for validation, you know, all the things, got married. And that is a good way to make all your trauma come out. I did not know that I was a survivor and everything my husband did triggered me, you know, and I couldn't figure out why. You know, but everything he did went into the pimp, like that category of violent, bad, dangerous, and like not really his fault, you know. And we had our daughter and separated. And once the separation, during that separation, just the healing came. It's a whole story. It's in my book. It's pretty awesome and amazing how the Lord worked in my life. But I was healed and someone told me that I was a survivor. And once I realized that, I started no longer looking through the lens of a victim. But now I was a survivor and I was empowered and I had to go out onto the streets and tell everyone else, like, if I'm a survivor and if I got off the streets and got clean and sober, maybe you can too. So I started making these bags with toiletries, soap, shampoo, conditioner, toothpaste, and I jump in my minivan with my kids And I'd go around where I lived and I'd jump out of the car when I'd see the women on the street and I'd hand them a bag. And they, you know, would cry and I'd hug them and I'd tell them there's some resources in the bag and there's a better way. I worked for an anti-trafficking organization in Boston called My Life, My Choice. Mm-hmm. And we did a lot of prevention work. I worked with young, young girls who were at high risk or had already been commercially sexually exploited. Wow. I worked for another safe house for women over 18. I went to many anti-trafficking conferences across the country. I started sharing my story. I started to realize that being authentic and transparent was healing other yeah. women because they would come up to me with tears streaming down their face, telling me that they had the same story. So I just kept pressing in and I kept doing the next right thing. My husband and I were able to reconcile because I worked through the forgiveness of my trafficker, of my husband, of myself, right? All the things, how much forgiveness heals trauma. I know that could be controversial, but for me, that's the truth. Mm-hmm. And then I was able to develop our organization that we have now called Jasmine Grace Outreach. So we still have the Bags of Hope, which is the outreach arm. We, mm-hmm. you know, give out over 1,000 bags a year to vulnerable and exploited women all over Massachusetts and Southern New Hampshire. And we go into halfway houses and jails and we run recovery groups to help women self-identify. Because again, like me, they don't know they're survivors and they're out there in that continuous cycle of addiction and homelessness, exploitation. Mm-hmm. And so we help self-identify. We help them exit by walking alongside, connecting them to services, safe houses across the country, et cetera. Wow. And just this year, I was able to open up a safe home, which like I'm beside myself. I can't even believe like this happens, like a dream come true. I've been doing the work for about 10 years. And I've obviously always in my heart wanted to have a home for women. But never pursued it in a sense, right? Like I just try right. to be faithful with what's put in front of me. I have 5 kids, you know, all together. I homeschool a few of the smaller ones. So like I got a lot going on, but yeah. in my heart, like always wanted a safe place for women. And long story, I met a couple who purchased a 17 bedroom home. It was a convent in the 80s. The Catholic sisters had it and they retired and they put it on the market. And this couple purchased it with the intent to rent it to a ministry for $1 a month. And wow. I have to pay other taxes and utilities, but it's this big, beautiful home, you know, in New Hampshire. We make fun of it's like in the sticks of New Hampshire. And it's on 15 acres. It's beautiful. And yeah, we're open now. We have a few women living there. And in the house that's connected on the property, there's a family, a husband and wife, and their 2 teenagers. They're like the farm and property managers. Mm-hmm. We have chickens. We're going to have goats as a way for the women to work with the animals and make goat lotions and soaps because we want to empower them economically and yeah. you know give them good, wholesome things to do and new skills and ways to work and hustle and dreams that they want to do. And so it's called Living Hope Farms. Okay. And yeah, so all that information's on our website. Right. My website is jasminegrace.org. Oh, yeah.
We will link all of this. And yeah. I love that the self-identification is so important, right? So from going from victim to survivor to empower the women. And I think proper identification, naming the thing is so important. So it's not a boyfriend, it's a pimp. It's not, you know, you're not empowered with this work. You're a victim there. And then you're a survivor. So calling things for what they are is a really important thing. And then the safe people. A couple of questions and then we will end with the safe house. But Jasmine, what laws impact trafficking and do they help or hurt victims? What's something that we as listeners should be aware of with respect to laws?
Yes, absolutely. There's a federal law about the TVPA. And that law was in 2000 and when trafficking really started to get language and laws put behind it, legislatures was able to start prosecuting traffickers and really stop arresting the victims, right? Because mm-hmm. back in the day, it was always the prostitute who was doing the crime and the trafficker and the buyer always were let free. And so nowadays they do go after the buyers and the traffickers more. And those stipulations are big. You know, I've heard of traffickers doing 20, 30, 40 years. Obviously it's easier to go after predators and traffickers who groom and traffic children because mm-hmm. you can give more of a time in jail for that. Mm-hmm. And it's harder with adult victims, again, to prove those one of those three elements because of the mental coercion, manipulation, and just the timing of it, right? Sure. Trying to get in there and get a girl to testify is very complicated and messy for many reasons. Sure. But yeah, the laws have come a long way. There's also a big push across the country to legalize prostitution, believe it or not, to decriminalize completely prostitution. Hmm. And don't hold the traffickers accountable, don't hold the buyers, and just make it completely decriminalize. And a lot of us say, wait a second, let's partially decriminalize, right? Where we actually arrest the traffickers and the buyers, but give the victims exit strategies and ways to recover, because we know that they're victims for the most part. Like the majority of people who end up in the commercial sex trade have been trafficked, have been abused, have drug addiction, mental illness, etc. There is a small amount of people who call themselves empowered sex workers that push for completely decriminalizing. But again, sex should not be called work. You don't come out of the commercial sex trade unscathed. It is just impossible. You come out with soul damage. So yes, I am glad that there have been laws put in place and them doing a lot more work towards that. But my trafficker is still out there. Once I figured out that everything that had happened to me, it had been past the statute of limitations. So after 10 years as an adult, you can't prosecute.
Wow.
When you're a child victim, you have a way longer time. I'm pretty sure like you could prosecute maybe 20, 30 years, depending on the state you're in.
Right.
After you're an adult, after it's happened. But I, you know, have given his information and his name to my connections at FBI and Homeland Security because I just wanted them to know, like, hey, he's still out there and maybe he'll pop up on your radar. But I feel like my advocacy work and helping so many other women in my book has done like so much more for the greater good that it's okay.
How do the survivors, come to you, or how are you able to kind of find survivors and then bring them into your program and have them come into the safe house? How does that work?
Yeah, mostly through our work that we do through the outreach, through the bags, through the groups, through just being in the community, knowing the women, word of mouth at this point, and then through our referrals, through, social workers, people who are in treatment centers, counselors, Homeland Security, local law enforcement that knows us. Yeah.
Okay. So you have other people, other safe people helping to connect you with the people who need the help the most. I love that. And so your organization, I know coming into, by the time this airs, you will have started a matching program. And I would love for you to tell our listeners about that so that they can support your organization, support this new safe house in any way they can. Can you tell us a little bit about this as we wrap up?
Yeah, thanks for that. So we are, homegrown missionaries in that sense. We raise our own support. We've been doing this work for about 10 years. So we have a fiscal sponsor because I don't want to run my own nonprofit. So I have somebody else do that hard administrative work for me.
Yeah.
And so the name of my fiscal sponsor is called The Cause. And you can check out our page. It goes right to them. They do all the financing and all the bookkeeping. And our match was because of a generous donor. An amazing friend, supporter of ours, gave $10,000, or will give $10,000, and will match that. So we're trying to raise another $10,000 so we can double it to have $20,000 by the end of November. So Giving Tuesday is, I believe, November 28th or November 27th. So it's the Tuesday after Thanksgiving. That's all I do know.
Yeah.
And so we're running that challenge from November 1st till then, right in time for the giving season, because it takes, $200,000 to $300,000 to run that home. Sure. Yes, it only costs us $1 a month in rent, but we have tons of utilities and taxes and food and therapy costs and all the things to house the survivors. And then for our outreach, I do have two employees plus me, right? So there's three of us that we pay small salaries to do the work, but really it just goes back into the ministry and the women that we serve.
I love that. And I'm going to, even though Giving Tuesday typically falls after Thanksgiving, it falls after people have had 4 days of shopping for things. And so I'm going to advocate here that consider Giving Tuesday to be the Tuesday before Thanksgiving. And why don't we give to the charities and the organizations that we support and truly give, not when we're depleted after buying the TV from Walmart. So I'm going to say Giving Tuesday should be the Tuesday before Thanksgiving. Jasmine, I could talk to you forever. This was an incredible conversation. I thank you so much for your courage, your bravery, the fact that you persevered, and the fact that you're passing it on to others. The biggest and most wonderful thing about a person becoming free is then helping others to become free, and you're doing the work. And it was an honor to be here with you. So thank you
so much.
Thank you, listeners, for sharing another episode with us. We are going to link everything that we talked about into the show notes, especially the giving match for Jasmine Grace. So thank you, Jasmine, and we hope that you'll come on again.
Absolutely. Thanks, Christine.
Okay, thanks. Bye. Thank you so much for spending another week with us. Follow us at Uncharted Living Podcast on Instagram and TikTok. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss any episodes. And please like and share this episode with your favorite fellow human. Uncharted.